I'd say it's a class of group of ownership and stewardship structures where you don't have private individual ownership. And as mentioned before, when we looked into this, we discovered that approximately 20% of the global GDP comes from these forms of business. It's not like we need to move everything to new business models. We actually have models that enable the circulation of profit, and that is what shifts us from a growth to a post-growth system, is when you have profit circulating so that it gets reinvested back into communities, back into the employees, etc., rather than accumulating in shareholder bank accounts, then you reduce the pressures that are created by debt expansion that's no longer there because you don't have capital accumulation. And that then changes the power dynamics in the global economy. That then changes the incentives for business. That then changes the pressures that come as externalities from capitalist growth, and actually allows for an economy on a macro scale to actually be designed within ecological limits for collective flourishing.
Hello and welcome. I'm Shiza Shah, your host of Re-envision Business and co-founder of UpEffect, a crowdfunding platform resourcing organizations shaping a benevolent economy inspired by justice and ethics. If you're new to our work, over the last decade, our team has enjoyed spotlighting organizations at the forefront of advancing financial equity, conservation, and economic empowerment. We're now deepening this work through our Re-envision Business podcast to dive deeper into what models are working and shaping the next economy. This series will highlight the emerging need for responsible trade that uplifts communities frequently left behind. In each episode, we'll invite thought leaders to deconstruct our current systems, and with their help, we'll amplify models that are re-envisioning business. Together, we'll unearth a blueprint for an economy redesign. Today, you're in for a very special episode. We're joined by five special individuals who are shaping a post-growth economy. We first hear from Donnie McLurkin, the Executive Director of the Post-Growth Institute. He's also a facilitator, author, and social entrepreneur, passionate about all things not-for-profit. Originally from Australia, Donnie spent the past decade in the US before moving to Argentina in 2022, from where he coordinates the Post-Growth Institute. He's worked in Egypt, Kenya, Fiji, Thailand, and South Korea, helping over 500 not-for-profit projects start, scale, and sustain their work. While his own initiatives include developing the Offers and Needs Market, Free Money Day, the Post-Growth Alliance, the Enrich List, the Not-for-Profit Way Training, Silent Skype Team Meetings, Project Australia, and the globally used Post-Growth Hashtag. An affiliate professor of economics at Southern Oregon University and fellow of the Royal Society of the Arts, Donnie holds a PhD in social science. He is working on his fourth book, How on Earth Our Future is Not-for-Profit. I'm also delighted that some of my fellow post-growth fellows were able to join us for this episode to share some of the incredible ways they are re-envisioning business to build the next economy. A huge thank you to Irint Sahan, Jessica Mason, Arbita Bisht, and Catherine Trebek. Without further ado, I bring you today's conversation on shaping a post-growth economy. Hi, Donnie. I'm so grateful that we could make this happen. Thank you so much for joining.
What a pleasure to be with you, Shiza. Thank you so much for the invitation.
It's been a real tremendous honor to be part of the Post-Growth Fellowship Program and to learn from the talented minds involved in this really, really crucial piece of work that we feel is behind shaping a better society and will play a very pivotal role in the future economy that gets built out through the purpose and profit lens. And some of the themes and values that underpin your work are just so similar to the work that we've been doing at UpEffect, whether it's solving for widespread economic injustice, social well-being, and looking at ecological and environmental conservation. It just feels like very familiar territory. And that's part of why I'm just so excited for others to learn more about you, Donnie, and the Post-Growth Institute, and how your team is re-envisioning how we build a brighter and better economy.
Thanks, Shiza. Isn't it just so good to realize there are so many people working on these important things and in such powerful ways.
Absolutely. It's always refreshing to find, similarities in other people's work. And it really is a collective effort for us to achieve the kind of impact we're all envisioning in our own enterprises or in our own field work. So really excited to contribute in some way to the work of the Post-Growth Institute. And Donnie, to set the scene a little bit in terms of, today's economic climate and why, you do the work that you do and why we do the work that we do. Can you please lay out what, in your view, is the current state of modern economics?
Well, that's a great question, and obviously a very broad one. When we talk about modern economics, I think it's important at the beginning to highlight that if we were to talk about a global capitalist market economy, that is only part of the picture. And in fact, the very framing of a global economy in some kind of homogenous way is part of the challenge that I think many groups around the world, particularly indigenous groups, groups focused on self-sovereignty, are trying to highlight, is that in reality, we live in a world where there are diverse forms of economy. Some of those forms of economy involve a formal market, things that many of us will be familiar with in terms of how trade occurs in both online and offline ways using formal market mechanisms and typical forms of largely Western finance. However, there are a multitude of economies that operate around the world. In fact, if you look at just the food system, for example, estimates by the ETC group are that 70% of the world's food is created by the peasant web, the peasant network, as they describe it. And so what's the state of the modern economy? The first thing is to say it's not just one thing, but in our global systems of formal market trade, which is a lot of the interests that I and the Institute have, the state is one of increasing disparity, increasing inequity, increasing forms of neocolonialism, from what I've seen, and that those things are a direct outcome of a system that is inherently racist and a system that is inherently inequitable, and a system that is predicated on the need, the dependency to grow, but grow in a way that actually has exploitation built into it through its capitalist underpinnings. So we live in an economy that is playing out in the international sense, in the homogenized sense that I'm describing here, in a way just as it's designed to do, which is to effectively present as if trade is raising all of the boats, so to speak, but in reality, it's actually exacerbating a lot of the exploitation and inequities that are baked into the capitalist neocolonialist formula.
Yeah, I feel like you've raised some really interesting points in terms of how the economy is designed to exploit some of our time and labor and societies that are very much dependent on trade and don't have the means to push for more favorable practices. And so really the work of shaping a better economy sits with those that have that privilege and those that have access to resources. And I'm curious, in your view, how do you anticipate post-growth economics and the work that you do to solve some of these challenges that you've outlined and that our current economy is up against?
Well, if we consider what a growth-dependent economy is, and for the purposes of this interview, when I say growth, I see that as synonymous with a capitalist economy, an economy that has both in the microeconomic sense with businesses the need to grow their profit margins, as well as in a macroeconomic sense the need for ever-expanding money supply, amount of money that is in the economy, and as we will probably delve into later, an ever-increasing supply of the debt stocks in the economy. In these senses, a capitalist system will always see an accumulation of money into the hands and the bank accounts, essentially, of the wealthiest individuals, the wealthiest households, the wealthiest corporations, and in a few select cases, the wealthiest governments. And this accumulation, this capital accumulation that underpins the profit-maximizing imperative that underpins capitalism and our current growth economy, gives this veneer, like it gives this sense for certain people of privilege who have that privilege, for example, to engage in purchasing where they want, you know, whether it's clicking a button on Amazon and having something delivered to their front door, gives them the perspective, this veneer that the economy works in the same way for everyone everywhere, that, oh, look, you can engage in trade, and as long as we've got things of value that we're offering into the world, then everyone can come through an experience of the market where resources are allocated in the most efficient way. But what it misses and what post-growth seeks to address is that there are these externalities that occur constantly through this capital accumulation. When money concentrates in the hands of certain individuals, corporations, etc., the equivalent experience elsewhere is usually an indebtedness. We know that this happens particularly across colonial, neocolonial lines, global south, global north, where so much of the wealth that has been accumulated and the money that continues to be accumulated through trade is on the backs of exploited labor, exploited working conditions, etc., exploited trade, trade deals that are inequitable. And so a post-growth system essentially says, hold on a moment. Not only are we facing ecological limits, right, which gets a huge amount of attention in new economy spaces these days, is the climate change issues that are very, very real. But it's not just that we're facing ecological constraints for humanity to thrive. It's that the very systems that have been driving us into ecological overshoot are not just unsustainable from an environmental perspective, they're unsustainable from a social perspective as well. As mentioned before, there's a racism that is inherent in the way that economies grow throughout the world. And so this shift that we're calling for into a post-growth future isn't just a shift into a more green future, you know, adopting things like renewable energy, etc. It's about actually exploring the underpinnings of our economy and taking a more holistic perspective to recognize that all living systems thrive when they have circulation built into them, when we have oxygen, nitrogen, for example, flowing through the biosphere. It enables our ecology to thrive. But those living systems die when there's an accumulation of nitrogen or CO2, for example. The same thing can be said for our economy, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, is broader than a single market economy. Our economies are essentially a construct that represents how we relate with each other and the natural world around us. And so when circulation is built into our economy, when we actually have a system that's not predicated on growing accumulation in a certain way, you have flows of materials, of power, of resources that's really healthy. Your family unit can survive, your community can thrive, your city can thrive, your international relationships can thrive. But when you have this accumulation built in, you have a very different circumstance that actually sees the necrosis build in the systems. And that's why we're seeing so much of the ecological challenges we're facing, is because there's these underpinnings that are broader than just ecological. They involve social and economic relationships as well. So post-growth seeks to say, hold on a second. If we drop into our bodies and feel what's going on, we feel the disconnect. We know that it doesn't work to have an economy or market trade that's built on accumulation. We need something that's got circulation built into it, not so that it can then grow, but so that it can actually meet needs according to where they are, and that collectively we can work together in ways where that energy, whether it's literally energy or metaphorically, energy flows to various parts of the system to assist in our collective process of thriving or seeking to be in relationship with the ecology around us.
I really love that. And you're, of course, doing some really interesting work in shaping that post-growth economy. And I think this is a good segue to touch on some of your talking points and why you believe debt plays such a crucial role in setting us up for that economic collapse and contributing to some of the problems that we're up against. And this concept of debt being so problematic actually aligns really well with the Islamic finance framework. While Islam welcomes the issuance of loans, it regards debt as a means to help people in need. And so rather using it as an exploitative instrument that can be monetized, it's actually meant to be an act of charity within the Islamic economic system. When borrowers struggle to make repayments, Islam encourages respite and forgiveness. And that's because a borrower that is requesting money is a person in need. And so it's not appropriate to take advantage of that person in need. And so debt plays a very, very small role in the Islamic economy. And we think that can translate into Western economies too, if done correctly. But if we look at how integral debt has become in modern financial instruments and the capitalistic economy, it becomes very, very difficult to understand how we are going to untangle some of the dependencies that our systems have on debt and just how accustomed people have become to using debt and leveraging debt to finance activities. Even if we look at, you know, some of the studies done by many global economists around the drivers of global recessions, many of them have concluded that as private debt increases, consumer debt decreases, which subsequently shrinks economic activity. And that validates Islam's stance on debt and what Islam advocates for. But can you please expand on why you believe debt is setting us up for economic collapse and how a post-growth economy might address the challenges that debt presents to society?
Absolutely. And, you know, various principles in Islamic finance, as you've mentioned, Qarz Hasan, the notion of riba and the avoidance of riba, this interest on debt, have been instrumental in my own development of exploring this area, inspiring, in fact. And it's another example of how when we look at from a Western perspective or a global minority, global North perspective around money and finance, it's so easy to think that everything's the same around the world. And then you discover, wow, the world of Islamic finance and this principle of not having interest-bearing loans is just a totally different perspective. Totally different, and is spread throughout billions of people's lives throughout the world. Different ways of being and doing, and it is crucial because if you take for example last year in Australia, the situation that emerged there around October, from memory, there was an article that said for the first time ever, Australia had moved to the top of the list in terms of per capita wealth in the world. It had surpassed Switzerland for the first time. So number one per capita wealth in the world. At the same time, I read an article that said that Australians had, again, for the first time ever, moved to number one place for the highest levels of household debt per capita in the world. Now, you'd say, how can those two things happen? Or even before that, you might say, if you read one of those articles, you'd be heavily influenced to think that the circumstances in Australia are either really good or really challenging. And this coexistence of these phenomena actually explains a lot, Shiza, of what you're speaking to here about how central debt is when explored or when developed through a capitalistic lens. Because in our present global economic system, and this expands to include Islamic forms of finance, we have the introduction of money through lending. It's loaned into existence, which means that when you create new money in the system, you have to have equivalent amounts of debt. And then, of course, in certain cultures, you have interest on top of that debt, as well as the ability to create new forms of loans without creating new forms of money, which is what happens when, for example, I take money that I might have in a bank account and purchase a government bond. I'm now creating a new debt from the government to me, but there's no new money in the system. I'm using existing money. So we have these situations that lead us to this circumstance globally of about 2.5 times the amount of debt to the amount of money in the system. In practicality, then, what happens is the scenario like in Australia, where people have very large mortgage debt, household debt that expands to credit cards, automobile debt, etc. And you would have on the surface, well, wealthiest nation per capita, but the lived experience of individuals is that they're under huge amounts of household stress. Because to have that amount of monetary accumulation, which is often associated with wealth accumulation, in the system, in a capitalist system where money is always extracted faster into a small number of hands than it is circulated back through taxation, wages, philanthropy, etc. What happens then is that the debt that matches that money in the system, as well as the other forms of debt that I mentioned, the interest and the ways that you can create debt without creating new money, has to accumulate somewhere else in the system. Mathematically, there's no way around this. And so that debt stress exists in our global economy. If you have, for example, an economy that is generating $1 trillion of new money supply in the system in terms of new loans, because the economy is thriving through a GDP lens and people are taking out new loans, that means there has to be $1 trillion at least of debt somewhere else in the system to balance things out. And in our capitalist growth economies, when that money accumulates somewhere, the debt accumulates elsewhere. And that piece then, which is compounded by exorbitant levels of interest in certain economies and cultures, that contrasts to what you're describing with Islamic finance, is foundational to the inequality and the racialized inequality that we see. I mean, thinking about debt flows, and I've seen different reports on this, but the typical synopsis I see is that about 12 times the amount of money that's flowing into the African continent in terms of aid is flowing out through repayments of interest on loans. I live in Argentina. What I can see here on a daily basis is inflation of over 100% now, directly relating to the inflows, outflows of money, and especially the dependency on the US dollar here, and the International Monetary Fund's negotiations that have this country under a thumb in terms of the amount of outgoings for debt repayments on interest on loans. So this is baked into the system. The fact that for every dollar of new economic growth, about 93%, 93 cents of that dollar ends up in the hands of the top 1%, and only 5 cents end up in the hands of the world's majority. That level of accumulation is why it actually creates then the need for the economy to keep growing to service the debt that keeps expanding. Because if you think about it, if you are struggling and you're indebted, and you don't have access to enough money through a wage or otherwise to actually pay off your debts, what do? You have to go into further debt. And that drives the global economy in this sort of pseudo healthy sense of GDP increasing. But in reality, we continue to move further down a precipice where the stress that is there at the household, business, and government levels increases until it breaks, until you have situations like here in Argentina 20 years ago where the banks just say, we're shutting and we're taking all of everyone's money and we're not going to be paying out the deposits. So we don't want circumstances like that. And the antidote to that is forms of economy where money circulates, whether it's gift economy, barter economy, forms of economy where the financing is done without the notion of interest or exorbitant interest, etc. But also, as we might touch on a little later, forms of business that actually don't participate in the accumulation of capital. And those make up 20% of our global GDP at the moment, forms of not-for-profit business where there aren't any owners, so there isn't the ability for shareholders to be accumulating capital and driving this unsustainable, inequitable, racially problematic neocolonial system.
So much to unpack there. And those are some really disturbing statistics and figures in terms of how wealth is being centered in small pockets around the world and how debt is a massive driver for wealth inequality and just incredibly unjust in how it shows up and keeps so many populations from progressing forward. Also that a few people in the world can benefit and profit from that. I'm curious, I know you've lightly touched on some business models that you feel are more beneficial to shaping that better economy. If you had to pick an ideal business model that you think would be at the forefront of, you know, solving some of these pressing problems that you've identified, what would that model look like?
That's such a great question. I would say it's not so much a business model as a class of ownership or stewardship structures that I would sort of bundle together. And this makes this distinction between for-profit and not-for-profit forms of business. To get to unpacking that, though, requires going back a little in the experience and telling a story of my own journey in this area. So in 2009, I was at a conference in Brisbane, Australia, a community development conference, and the keynote speaker got up and spoke about his engineering company. It had an annual turnover of about 12 million Australian dollars. It was working in civil and construction engineering, surveying bridges, roads, these sorts of things, with a staff of about 50 people. And then he said the words that changed the course of my life. He said, "And we're not for profit." Now, until that point, I had always thought of certain businesses as being for profit, especially engineering companies. So I went up to the speaker afterwards and I said, "Tell me a little bit about this. What do you mean you're not for profit?" He said, "Well," he was an Indigenous Australian man. He said, "Us mob, we're not interested in profiting personally from a business. We're interested in the community and what we can do for each other. It's not in our ways of being to think about private accumulation in Westerner ways, white fellow ways." He said, "We therefore pooled some of the money that we had individually to create the startup capital for this business. We set it up as a not-for-profit incorporated in order to be able to proceed legally. And then when it was profitable, we paid back those loans, I think without interest, on the startup capital to all of the original founders." That business, Myuma, continues to be a successful not-for-profit business. And it taught me that there are ways of doing business that throughout the world, since I've studied this with my colleague Jen Hinton, we realize that no matter where the jurisdiction around the world, and there are very different forms of jurisdiction throughout this planet, but there is a consistency of differentiating between something that is for-profit and not-for-profit. For-profit is where you have private individual equity owners within a company, and not-for-profit is where you don't. And we're talking here about forms of business, which for us is groups that are bringing in at least 50% of their revenue from forms of trade that self-generated revenue of at least 50%. So most people, when I say the words not-for-profit, think non-profits. And when they think non-profits, they think traditional charities. 2 points on that. One is that I'm talking about forms of business that are not-for-profit, which is wider than non-profit. It includes foundation-owned businesses, like Patagonia, for example, which has recently shifted to that model, IKEA, Bosch, the engineering company. These are all not-for-profit forms of business with foundation ownership. Then you have consumer cooperatives, big ones in the US where I used to live, like Navy Credit Union with billions of dollars of capital that are not-for-profit. There's no private individual owners in those credit unions in the US, for example. Government enterprises, where you'll see a government owning and running, operating as a business and activity. And then nonprofits that have business models. And this is the most interesting one for me, is that most people, again, when you're thinking about nonprofits, they're thinking charities. Something interesting happened that Lester Salmon and his team out of Johns Hopkins University documented over the past few decades. Nonprofit organizations throughout the world got tired of being dependent on philanthropy, and they went into business. So your local religious organization might run a cafe alongside its activities as a way to actually cover some of its costs, for example. Gyms around the world started to sell both their services and memberships and additional things like the vending machines, to actually ensure that they could run their costs in ways that needed less charity support. And in fact, less than 20% of the world's nonprofit organizations' funding comes from charity. In fact, probably the best example of this is BRAC, the world's biggest NGO. It has over $1 billion of revenue. It employs over 120,000 people, largely women, works across 10 different countries in education, healthcare, banking, etc. And BRAC is a not-for-profit organization. Less than 20% of its income is from charity. The rest it generates through the activities that it runs, the businesses that it runs, including Arong, its craft stores, which is the biggest craft-based label fashion label that's craft-based and artisan-based in all of Bangladesh. It has artificial insemination research laboratories. It has bakeries. It runs banking institutions, etc. So you asked what model, and I'd say it's a class of group of ownership and stewardship structures where you don't have private individual ownership. And as mentioned before, when we looked into this, we discovered that approximately 20% of the global GDP comes from these forms of business. It's not like we need to move everything to new business models. We actually have models that enable the circulation of profit, and that is what shifts us from a growth to a post-growth system, is when you have profit circulating so that it gets reinvested back into communities, back into the employees, etc., rather than accumulating in shareholder bank accounts, then you reduce the pressures that are created by debt expansion that's no longer there because you don't have capital accumulation. And that then changes the power dynamics in the global economy. That then changes the incentives for business. That then changes the pressures that come as externalities from capitalist growth, and actually allows for an economy on a macro scale to actually be designed within ecological limits for collective flourishing.
Thank you for sharing that. So much of what you have said has been validated by a big shift that we're now seeing towards some of those stewardship structures. We're seeing a new wave of organizational design and rethinking how we do trade so that it is beneficial for people and the planet. And I know that the Post-Growth Institute is at the forefront of redefining and shaping some of those structures and helping organizations transition towards more beneficial models to circulate profit and other crucial resources. What led to the development of the Post-Growth Institute? And for those new to your work, can you please expand on what your organization does?
We did a survey about 3 years in to the Institute's founding, which occurred in 2010. So in 2013, we did this survey of, was there a book that influenced the people who were involved? You know, if they could name one book, what would it be? Amazingly, everyone cited the same book as the inspiration for their being involved. And that book was Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher. It's a book that I read during my PhD studies, maybe around 2004, 2005, and essentially looked at a future that took both the best of where things were going through modernity, as well as an appreciation for the local, the indigenous, the stewardship approach, and the commons, and sort of merged those in with a sprinkling of Buddhist philosophy. And that piece, that if I go back to my childhood, where I grew up in a very privileged part of the world, probably the wealthiest suburb of the world in the Southern Hemisphere, what I noticed from a very early age that I now would describe as systems feeling is that things just didn't feel right. I would see people driving around in a vehicle that was supposedly more energy efficient, but I would see them showing that vehicle off in a way that was encouraging others to essentially follow in their footsteps and purchase another vehicle, for example. And this sense of feeling things being off, which I think all human beings have, and I suspect some of us walk around with different levels of cognitive dissonance around that, this sense that things are off led me from a young age to get involved in social justice movements and different activities in my own community, but ultimately led to work that said that the economics piece, the exploitative piece, stems most from the capitalist growth imperative and the profit-maximizing behavior. And it's crucial to sort of double down on that, because it highlights that the people out there who are doing most of the harm, the people who are heads of industry that are, you know, greenwashing their businesses in certain ways, perhaps, if at all, it's not that they're necessarily making mistakes that are their fault, so to speak. Yes, there's such a thing as willful sort of ignorance, but in reality, most of those people are following a playbook of how to be a business person, for example, and how to succeed in business. I mean, the amount of literature and webinars and indoctrination into success is this. It's growing your business. It's growing your profit margins, etc. That doesn't match up with the lived experience of the majority of small business owners around the world, and certainly doesn't match up with the majority of how the world's vast majority lives, which is sufficiency, enough, trade-offs that ensures well-being isn't traded off for ever-increasing growth in a way that actually is detrimental to your individual or collective health. And so I got to this work from recognizing that it was the economic underpinnings and the fact that so many executives around the world and leaders were stuck in a system they couldn't get out of. They didn't know how to get out of this. And I was interested in bringing together 9 other people from around the world to sort of say, okay, how can we be strategic? How can we actually come at this not from a space of disembodied rational strategy, but actually embodied strategy that recognizes that we're feeling a lot of things all the time? How do we engage in ways that can actually bring people into conversations, bring people into explorations, rather than a divisive, hey, capitalists, you know, people who drive capitalism forward, you're all evil, and therefore, you know, we need to point that out a little more clearly so people just get it, and then when they get it, it's going to change things. That doesn't work in our experience. Instead, creating the new avenues that draw people into what can work, what is already working. How do we build on the existing trends, like the increasing competitiveness of not-for-profit forms of business, like, as you said, Shiza, the renewed or new interest in steward ownership in formal market economics? These things are really important trends that, if we galvanize them together and say, hey, these are coalescing into, in our language, a post-growth, or in other people's language, a post-development or post-capitalist or degrowth perspective, there's some real richness there that actually gives an opportunity for everyone, not just people like me who are passionate about this stuff, but actually everyone to actually contribute to a future that works for us all, for their grandkids, for our grandkids, etc. And I think this sort of exploration of how do we create a collective vision that honors the diversity of 8 billion people around the world and the different cultural contexts. I think that this is a challenge that inspires me and our institute to really go into the unknown and sit with the unknown, the uncomfortability of the unknown, and not seek to say we have all the answers, but seek to inspire from a space of what we're learning and observing and what we can help coalesce that's already forming in the ecosystems we inhabit. Our primary program is called the Offers and Needs Market. It's a two-hour process that we have trained 270 people in from around 60 countries across the world in how to facilitate that takes people on a journey of revealing the passions, knowledge, skills, and resources they may have access to in their own lives that they might want to share with others in their community. There's more information at offersandneeds.com, and there's an invitation for anyone in the world seeking to reclaim the economy through both informal and formal mechanisms, so gift, barter, negotiation, as well as the ability to have paid exchange. That's primarily the main activity that the Institute runs. We also have other things that can be found on the website, and this fellowship is a crucial piece of that as we seek to deepen into our understanding of how people are interpreting and engaging with post-growth itself.
We got to hear from some of the incredible individuals that are part of the Post-Growth Fellowship Program and learn how they are shaping a post-growth economy through their own work.
My name is Erinç Sahan. I'm based in the UK, but I'm originally from Turkey. I grew up in Australia. We migrated to Australia when I was a young child. So I'm from a few places, a bit of a confused identity, but still identify mostly as Turkish.
My name is Catherine Trebek, and I'm currently based on Ngunnawal country in Canberra, which is the capital of Australia.
Hi, my name is Jessica Mason, and I'm the executive director at Start.coop. I'm based in Chilmark, Massachusetts in the United States of America. I live on a small island off the coast of Massachusetts, and I am Australian-American. I was born in the US, I grew up in Australia, did all my schooling there, and moved back to the US as an adult. I've also spent a lot of my career working in Latin America, and so I really am grateful to have had a number of experiences in a number of different countries that have shaped both the work I do as well as who I am as a person.
My name is Dr. Arpita Bisht. I'm from India, and I am a postdoctoral fellow at the International Institute of Social Studies at the Erasmus University Rotterdam in the Netherlands.
The fellows are taking an incredibly diverse approach to addressing some of the most pressing problems affecting people and the planet today, whether they're looking at political ecology, ecological distribution conflicts, environmental justice, the donor economics model, business transformation, cooperative structures, inclusion and access, or social justice and systems change. A lot of these approaches are being interwoven into the daily work that each of these fellows are engaged in.
I'm working to create tools around donut economics that apply to the world of business. So in my day job, I'm the business and enterprise lead at Donut Economics Action Lab, and I'm tasked with taking the concepts of donut economics into the world of business. What we've done is we've created a set of tools that anybody within a business or working with businesses can use that helps them facilitate a workshop, that helps them engage with the concept of donut economics. It means that they look at some of the most regenerative and distributive ideas that they will need to pursue, those strategies, those actions, those practices that they'll need to take forward, and then look at the way the deep design of their business is either holding back those ideas and can enable them through evolving that deep design of business. So a lot of my work is focused specifically on transforming what we call the deep design of business. This includes looking at the purpose of the business, the networks of the business, the ownership model, the governance model, and the financial structures. So some of those really structural design elements that dictate the way decisions are made, that dictate where money goes, that dictate how investments are made, and the kind of requirements that can hold back or enable the bold actions needed to make a degrowth or post-growth world possible. In terms of the broader range of work, it also means that we work to support a community of practice around this, people that are engaging with these ideas of transforming the deep design of business. And it means that there are lots of consultants, people involved in business education at different universities, experts of various kinds that work with companies in the business ecosystem, startup hubs. There are a number of impact hubs, for instance, involved in this broader community of practice. And these are people that are taking the ideas of donut economics and bringing it to the world of business. And the last bit that really is one of the focus areas is the world of finance. What will finance need to look like in a donut economy that is in that post-growth mindset? And we're working with an organization called Transform Finance to explore new financial models that can unlock and enable the kind of transformations we need to see in the business space.
I'm at the moment doing a whole lot of different projects. So my diary feels a little bit like that 1980s video game of Tetris as I try to sort of piece them all together. So I'm working for quite a few different organizations that are all relevant in different ways to the idea of post-growth. I'm advising the Club of Rome on their Earth for All project, particularly really thinking about how do we get the ideas inherent in their Earth for All project into policy and what the challenges are with that. I've got a role with the University of Edinburgh with a rather cool title of Writer at Large, and they're working with their compassion initiative. And so I'm really exploring how compassion and the economy can come together a bit more and what that means. I also have two roles here in Australia, two Australian-based organisations, one called the Centre for Policy Development, and I'm advising their work on getting the ideas of collective wellbeing and more upstream preventative work at the source of the problems into government. And the other piece I'm doing is advising a lovely little group called The Next Economy, who are just punching way above their weight in terms of really helping regions that need to go through a process of decarbonisation away from a dependency on fossil fuel industries. So I'm working with them to think about how can they bring their voice to conversations about the macro economy. And then on top of all of that, I'm really loving still doing in sort of individual ad hoc talks and bits of writing and support and advice. And I've got a few voluntary board roles and things that I'm on as well. And also, obviously, associated with the Post-Growth Institute as a fellow this year.
At Start.coop, we are a nonprofit that's focused on cultivating the next generation of cooperative businesses with ambitions of scale. Our goal is to really help folks understand that there's an alternative way of thinking about business and thinking about ownership that is values aligned and can really work towards a brighter future and a more equitable future. That's really our goal. We see rampant wealth inequality. We see rampant racial inequality. And we know that ownership holds the keys to lessening that inequality, to really making a difference. When you grow up poor, you think about the accumulation of cash or savings as your path out of poverty. But what we often fail to acknowledge is the role that ownership, whether that's home ownership or business ownership, plays. And if you look at the wealthiest people in the world, these are people who have accumulated immense wealth through business ownership. And we're really interested in using business ownership as a tool to reduce inequality.
I am a political ecologist, critical scholar, and a scholar activist working on conflicts and defensive social resistance movements that emerge as a consequence of socioeconomic and environmental injustices at frontiers of natural resource extraction. I'm currently working on comparative political ecology of conflicts around extraction, distribution, and consumption of natural resources and the ecosystems from which they're extracted. The focus of my work is mostly on the Global South, and I work on both South-South as well as South-North comparative analyses of conflicts around ecosystems and natural resources. Based on the nuanced understanding of conflicts around resources, all of my solution-oriented work involves designing mineral policies at the national level, as well as conceptualizing pathways towards more socio-ecologically efficient and ecologically viable ways of organizing mineral extraction, distribution, consumption, and access, based on the principles of post-growth economics.
What does post-growth mean to these fellows in the context of their work?
It essentially means going beyond the paradigm of the 20th century economics that we have all inherited in the world around us. And it means going beyond the need to pursue endless growth in the broader economy. But what does this mean for business? Well, it means the way it manifests essentially in the world of business is this pursuit of endless growth of sales, the endless growth of profits, the endless growth of the share price, in the dividends that are paid, all of these demands that finance makes on business to grow everything. And if it's not the route to maximum growth of profits, growth of dividends, growth of margin, share price, sales, then it can't be pursued. This is something that has been hardwired into the world of business and finance. A lot of people working in sustainability are trapped in this paradigm that they can only pursue sustainable solutions if they can demonstrate that there will be even greater profits, greater returns, greater dividends, greater higher share price, growth of sales. And that limitation, that straitjacket we've put on the world of business is holding back the kind of progress we need to make to help humanity live within the means of living planet and meet the needs of all people on this living planet. So in terms of the broader transition, that will mean that in order to pursue a post-growth mindset in the business world, we can't just hope to convert individuals, convince them, who are people who are in leadership positions, because they're trapped within incentive structures and systems that will force them to maximize returns, maximize growth, maximize profits, dividends, etc. And that maximizing growth model has to also be redesigned. And that's where a lot of the focus of my work is. What would that look like to redesign business, to redesign finance, so that it isn't pursuing maximum financial extraction, but it is actually pursuing maximum benefits for society and for the living planet?
The idea of post-growth to me essentially means a fundamental rethinking about the way we think about the economy in terms of its role, beyond seeing it as a goal in its own right, and really rethinking, is the economy in service of what I describe as higher order goals, namely social justice on a healthy planet, what a lot of us in would describe as a well-being economy, so an economy designed to deliver the well-being of people and planet. And post-growth means really saying the economy can be better than dependent and reliant on growth. It also means calling time on those 20th century recipes, the idea that you just grow the economy faster, and that the assumption being that that will automatically lead to addressing, to sort of sorting out and solving all the challenges that societies and communities and individuals face, because we know that that hasn't worked. We know wealth hasn't trickled down, and we know those recipes have also come with huge pressure on our precious natural home. And so the post-growth agenda, to me, is the opportunity to open up those assumptions and point out their flaws and hold a mirror up to just their inadequacy and how they haven't worked and how they're now in the times of the reality of planetary boundaries as we see all around us, to take a good hard look at the role of the economy and think, what sort of economy do we need, and then design it deliberately and purposely for that. To me, it's not a binary of yes growth, no growth, or even agnostic to growth. I'm extremely, extremely fussy about growth. I think we should be really thinking very deliberately and deeply about what we need more of and what sort of things we need to nurture and inculcate and encourage and grow in our societies and in our economic ecosystem. So community-owned renewables, worker cooperatives, participatory budgeting, public transport, community gardens, tool libraries, all those sorts of things we need more of. But it's very much taking a very deep, hard look about what sort of growth we need. I often think that the term growth is a little bit abstract, and it's a bit like the term move. So if someone said to you, hey, move, you wouldn't know what to do. The first thing you'd do is ask them some questions. Well, what sort, move left, right, faster, slower, up, down, over there, over here? And I think we need to sort of have those similar questions when it comes to growth. What sort of growth do we need to really, and where and how to serve the purpose of social justice on a healthy planet? So to me, the post-growth agenda means opening up those conversations and very much getting the economy to serve humanity rather than the other way around.
Recognizing that if we continue down the path we're on, we will continue to create deeper and deeper inequities. And I'm really interested in moving beyond what we know today and what we do today into a post-growth reality where instead of focusing purely on profit, whether instead of centering the interests of those who hold power, we instead shift to a model where we hold profit in parallel or in partnership with purpose, people, and planet. And when we successfully move to a place where we are taking into account each of these four P's, then I think we start to reevaluate the role and the sort of primacy of growth and think about a more holistic view of how we can create a more equal society and economy that works for everyone.
How do these fellows hope to contribute to the shaping of a post-growth economy?
I guess there are a number of ways, and they probably break down into two categories. One is to demonstrate a new model, new mindset, new approach and design of business. And of course, this builds on the shoulders of giants of the models that have been an alternative already in this space. Models like the cooperative movement and the cooperative model, social enterprises that have got an asset lock and reinvest the majority of their profits back in their social mission, or examples like steward ownership that use foundation ownership structures to lock in the purpose and separate power and money in the ownership model of a business. Examples like post-growth entrepreneurship, which I know has been a really important part of the post-growth narrative more broadly. So those are the sorts of ideas that we're building on, but really trying to encourage a greater degree of diversity, a greater degree of innovation in the practice of designing businesses and really steering businesses away from that sort of 20th century, now outdated model of shareholder capitalism that has become a bit of an accepted norm in the mainstream. So that's one, is to really pursue, catalyze, support all these innovations, all the practice of alternatives in the business design space. The other is around the narrative, in trying to support a broader narrative shift, especially among policymakers, but among people involved in the business ecosystem more broadly, that something else is possible, something else is desirable, something else is also viable, that these alternatives do work. And what if we were to build on these examples that are working within an ecosystem that isn't designed for them, but instead could be adapted and adjusted to pursue that sort of goal? Imagine if we changed the policy environment to make it deliberately favorable for businesses that are going to focus on being regenerative and distributive in all of their strategies, in all of their actions. So that's the sort of broader space, a lot of practice shift among those who have the agency to and the ambition to reshape businesses and those working in business, and then the other trying to shift the narrative more broadly, especially among policymakers, but broader audiences as well.
The way I try to contribute to a post-growth economy is through different work I do, with supporting different organisations, writing, speaking a lot about how we need to ask harder questions about the economy. So really very deliberately trying to plant seeds in people's minds, particularly wider audiences, not so much those who are of the movement, but wider audiences like local councils or community groups or business groups, and try to plant seeds that enables them to take another look at the assumptions that they may have had about the economy. In the past few years, I guess my biggest contributions have been around as a co-founder of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, where I'm still an ambassador, but I'm not playing such a key role in driving and supporting We All as an organisation anymore. And also in instigating the Wellbeing Economy Governments Partnership. So that's Scotland, New Zealand, Iceland, Finland and Wales and Canada to all intents and purposes. And these are governments who, gosh, are not there yet in the post-growth space, but there are people within them and they're ready to ask questions about the role of gross domestic product as a proxy for progress and to really think about how can you put ideas of collective wellbeing into the heart of economic policy making. And I guess the other way I contribute to post-growth thinking is doing as best I can, knowing that I still live in this current paradigm, doing as best I can to lighten my environmental footprint through, you know, through my consumption patterns and through the way I live and choices I make. I will say that's, be honest, it's really hard. With the nature of my work means I sometimes have to fly. But I do my very, very best to never buy things new as much as possible. I'm vegan. We don't have particularly, well, I think it's a big house compared to where I lived in Scotland, but compared to Australian standards where I am now, it's pretty small. We're trying to make it as energy efficient as possible, try to get public transport as much as I can, and try to support also community initiatives where it's people coming together, whether that's for a festival or a market or a book discussion. I try to support those sorts of initiatives that are communities being together and having fun and hanging out and being joyous, but not on the basis of consumption. But I will hold my hands up and say, you know, it is obviously really hard to be perfect in those choices when we still so much live in a growth-orientated paradigm.
To me, post-growth is about looking at our existing economy and our existing society and recognizing its ills, recognizing that it doesn't work for everybody, and recognizing that if we continue down the path we're on, we will continue to create deeper and deeper inequities. And I'm really interested in moving beyond what we know today and what we do today into a post-growth reality where instead of focusing purely on profit, whether instead of centering the interests of those who hold power, we instead shift to a model where we hold profit in parallel or in partnership with purpose, people, and planet. And when we successfully move to a place where we are taking into account each of these four P's, then I think we start to reevaluate the role and the sort of primacy of growth and think about a more holistic view of how we can create a more equal society and economy that works for everyone. All of the work that I do at Start.co-op is really centered on contributing to shaping a post-growth economy. We are solely focused on helping create businesses that share ownership and that are putting people, planet, purpose, and profit in alignment to really build the economy of the future. And one of the ways we do this is really through a focus on who's creating value and who is rewarded for value in these businesses. So the traditional economy doesn't reward those who create value. It doesn't reward the workers. It doesn't reward the consumers or the producers. It rewards those who already hold power and privilege, who are most often the founders and the investors. And what we're trying to do is to build a next generation and a new generation of businesses that are rewarding those who create value rather than those who extract it. And the reward is ownership. It's sharing both in the financial bounty of success and also sharing in governance and decision-making, having a voice and contributing to the direction and outcomes of the business in which you're engaged. And we think that by supporting the growth of cooperative business, we are really contributing to reshaping our existing economy in pursuit of one that is more equitable and frankly more robust and resilient.
How are the fellows re-envisioning business through their work?
Essentially, it's going deep into those structures of business itself. It's going deep into the ownership model, deep into the governance model, into the boardroom, into the way that financial structures are so ever present in dictating what is possible for businesses to do. So One of the things we do, and it's a part of the tool that we have available at donuteconomics.org, is for businesses to begin by going deep into the kinds of regenerative and distributive ideas that they can think of. Often these are the ideas that are not on the table. These are ideas like, well, let's actually redesign products to not just make them recyclable or not just reduce waste, but let's have it so that they are modular. So they're modular by design and they can be repaired, they can be upgraded, they can have a far longer life cycle. Let's design out waste completely if possible. What about ideas such as, well, we're talking about improving wages in global supply chains and maybe one day we'll get to a living wage, but hey, what if everyone had more than double a living wage? What would that look like? What would the prices need to look like in a global supply chain to enable people to get out of this poverty trap that so many hundreds of millions of farmers, workers, artisans are trapped in around the world? What would it look like to be committed to a community for the foreseeable future, for the production of products, for service delivery, for creation of jobs? And what would it look like to pay, for instance, a fair share of tax, not try to minimize your tax bill? So these are the kinds of ideas that we're sort of focusing on in trying to trigger. And inevitably, what it means for businesses when they identify these sorts of ideas is that they're held back from doing it. You know, their net margin requirements might mean they can't redesign a product so that it is, you know, got a modular product design behind it. They need to keep generating the kind of sales volume to justify their business model. Or it might mean that, hey, they can't pay the prices that will enable workers and farmers in a supply chain to get out of poverty, to meet their basic needs and go beyond. They're just not liberated to do that because of their financial structures. They're not able to put the investment in, for instance, to transform the manufacturing from a very carbon intensive model all the way to a regenerative model that maybe sequesters carbon, not just reduces the carbon footprint, but actually starts to mimic the benefits of nature that would ordinarily be there, that create benefits, not just minimize and reduce harm. So those are the sorts of ideas we try to get on the table. And once they get on the table, they feel a little bit unviable, impractical, out of reach for most business leaders and people say, look, this isn't possible. This feels unrealistic. And this is where we say, good, it should feel unrealistic. It should feel like it's a stretch. It should feel like it's testing what's possible within the design of your business. So now let's have a look at how the design of your business is holding you back. Let's have a look at how the ownership model means that actually the pressure from shareholders means you can't make that internal investment to unlock these ideas. You can't shift the margin expectations to enable you to redesign products, to change your marketing strategies, to change your business model. That will mean you need to now have a look at your governance model, for instance. It will mean that you'll need to look at how your ownership model evolves. Hey, who's represented on your board? Should your board have representatives of your workers on there, of your supply chain on there, of your community on there? What about nature? I mean, we're beginning to see innovations in enterprise design that are putting various stakeholders as representatives in the boardroom, bringing that voice into practice and making sure that stakeholder governance is not just a mantra, but a reality. So that's the kind of journey we're trying to take businesses through. And we think it's helpful to keep this a little bit open for businesses to define for themselves and to build on a pragmatic reason to redefine and change their business design. Those that are convinced by existing models like cooperatives and social enterprises and steward ownership, fantastic. That's great. There are fantastic organizations pushing for the promotion of those fantastic, amazing models. What we want to do is reach another sort of set of businesses that aren't convinced by specific off-the-shelf models, but might want to innovate elements of their design. And maybe there isn't a name yet for this, for having set different kinds of stakeholders represented on the board, or having a model where there's a dividend cap. That means that internally businesses can invest in the solutions that they need to benefit society and nature. So those are the kind of approaches and disposition we try to promote through our work. And I think it allows people to re-envision business in a much broader way. It allows people to understand that businesses need not be defined by how they've been designed in the past. They can be redesigned, and In fact, maybe every business will have a different structure, a different design, different ownership model, different financial structure, different purpose underpinning it, a different model of governance. And that sort of diversity can mean that more people are drawn in. They don't feel like it's imposed on them. Strict, you know, rules and limits are imposed on them. And it starts to change the conversation into a structural one. It starts to go from a conversation around, well, let's just, you know, do the best we can within the limits of the shareholder capitalism model to, hey, we can actually change this. This isn't sort of an unchangeable reality. This is something we can decide on. This is something we have a choice to design and define as needed. And we have pragmatic reasons for doing this because we need to belong to an economy of the future and to take the actions necessary to belong to that economy of the future. We'll need to also transform very difficult but critical aspects of our deep design.
To me, the role of business in a post-growth society is really, really important discussion. And I think what gives me hope is that there are a lot of really, really cool enterprises around already that show doing business from a different motivation. So it's almost like using being commercially viable as a tool rather than the goal in itself. It's almost like the micro version of seeing untangling means and ends and growth at the macro economy. This is saying, this is businesses and enterprises saying, yeah, we need to be commercially viable. We need to make a profit to be able to keep going, but we're not for profit. That's not our goal. Our goal is not to extract profit and channel it up to, say, remote shareholders. It's about being commercially viable so that we can deliver social and environmental benefits. And there are so many examples of that around the world, and all sorts of different business models emerging from the economy, from the common good balance sheets to B Corps to worker co-ops, obviously, which predate modern corporations, to social enterprises, to community interest companies, to community lands trusts, all sorts of things. And I imagine there's loads more in different countries that I'm not aware of. And I think that's really exciting because it shows there are different ways of doing business rather than just the sort of idea, the stereotypical view of business as all being about greed and extraction and rent seeking. And I find these pioneers really inspiring. There's one beer company outside Glasgow where I used to live, where I really think the guy who runs that gets up every morning thinking, how can he make his business more sustainable? He's all about being part of the local community. He even has a line of beer made out of old bread from a bakery that would have thrown it away. And instead of keeping his cans of beer together using those plastic rings, he has something made out of prawn shells. I'm really excited. I'm visiting this weekend. I hope a really cool restaurant called Ree, and it's in Sydney. And they say everything you touch would have gone to landfill. So their trendy interior design, their bar stools and their bar benches are all made from plastic that would have been a throwaway. And even their food and their cocktails comes from other restaurants that they would have thrown away, these you know, food and substances and so on. So I'm really excited to see that. But it's also much bigger organizations such as Arup Engineering, Mondragon, Triodos Bank, the Scandinavian Foundation Companies. All of these are examples of enterprises that have a bigger purpose rather than just short-term profit extraction. And they're the sort of businesses we need more of in a post-growth well-being economy.
Everything we're doing is about saying, let's look at traditional business. Let's look at the way companies are structured today. Let's look at their ownership models and let's figure out what's not working and why they're contributing to and driving, in fact, deepening inequality. And let's do something about it. Let's create an alternate model and really not create it. This is a model that's been around for centuries. Let's build on this existing model that we know can share ownership and have really profound impacts on the lives of the people that are creating value in these businesses and are rewarded with ownership. And so everything we do at Start.coop, all of our work, all of my work is really centered around this idea of re-envisioning what it means to be a founder, what it means to be a worker, and what it means to be a part of a business in this century. And we think that if we do that, we're going to be working towards a much more equitable economy and society at large.
Here are some ways that our listeners can learn more about the work that these fellows are involved in.
So how can people learn more about this work? Well, if you go to donuteconomics.org, we have got a page under themes. If you select business and enterprise, you can see our tools. And currently we've got three tools available there. One tool is our core tool, and that's sort of a full journey through this process of applying donut economics to business with a view to transforming the deep design of business itself. And by the way, the work on enterprise design is drawn heavily from and has been in collaboration with Marjorie Kelly, who's at the Democracy Collaborative and has been a key thinker and change maker on enterprise design. So that's one of our tools. We've also got a taster version of that tool that draws on Marjorie Kelly's work, which is a two-step sort of two-hour workshop tool. And all the slides are available to run a workshop. All the activity sheets are there, activity canvases, all the case studies are there, and guidance for the facilitator. So we've got Miro boards, and if you're doing it online, we've got PDFs if you're doing it in person for you to print out. So all sorts of materials available for someone to run a workshop with companies and business leaders on this. And then the third tool we've got listed on there is one we did with the University of Colorado Boulder's Media Design Lab, looking at how regenerative community ownership models can be supported by policy. So how policymakers can engage with these ideas and these models and can deliberately shape tax policies, public procurement, regulatory approaches, legal forms to directly target a transformation in business design. So not just regulate the market differently, but change the fundamentals of the businesses that make up and populate that market. Changing ownership models, examples from, for instance, employee ownership transitions that have happened as a result of tax changes that favor selling a business to the workers of that business, or examples like public procurement that very actively favor enterprises that have mission primacy locked in through examples like social enterprise or cooperatives. So those are the sorts of policies that people can go through. So three tools available: the core business design, donut design for business tool, the taster donut design for business tool, and the regenerative and regenerative community ownership tool, which is focused on policymakers, all at donuteconomics.org under the business and enterprise thematic page that you can access.
So in terms of learning more about my work, I have a website. I'm terrible keeping it updated as much as I should, but there's a contact form there. You can get in touch if you want a yarn. I'm on Mastodon and I'm on Twitter. And there's various ways you can get in touch. Apologies if I'm a bit slow replying, but love to hear from you and have chats. And yeah, I try to put up things that I speaking and writing I do on my website if you're interested in hearing a little bit more about how I phrase things and some of the key points I make around how we can transform our economy so that it's more humane and more sustainable.
To learn more about our work, you can visit us online, www.start.coop. You can follow us on social, or you can reach out and take advantage of any of the number of resources we offer, including monthly Ask Me Anything sessions, a free online Lean Co-op course, and a bunch of other tools and resources that we make available for folks who are interested in learning more about Start.coop or interested in potentially starting a cooperative themselves. It's really great to be doing this work in community with so many fantastic people, and I would invite anyone who's interested to join us and to be a part of the movement.
You can learn more about my work by following my Twitter handle at Arpita Bisht, or from my websites on the International Institute of Social Studies at the Erasmus University, Rotterdam, as well as my website on the Albert Hirschman Center on Democracy at the Graduate Institute, Geneva.
Donny, some of the fellows have shared what their hopes and dreams are for a post-growth economy. And I'm curious, what are your hopes and dreams for the fellowship program? And what are some ways you believe this will play a role in fulfilling the aspirations you have outlined today for the Post-Growth Institute?
The Post-Growth Fellowship is a nine-month experience where we bring together around 25 people, and this year largely Global South oriented or based academics, researchers, activists, artists or entrepreneurs, is our attempt to shine a spotlight on the diversity, Right? And this isn't, there's racial diversity, there's geographic diversity, there's cultural diversity, there's religious diversity, there's ideological diversity, yet with a common thread of embodied practice and embodied connection that comes from a space of like humble exploration and curiosity and a commitment to working out how we thrive collectively on this beautiful blue orb. That in itself is enough for me. Whenever you have a group of people that are grounded in local practice and grounded in an embodied experience, so they're not just trying to intellectualize their way through the world, but they're actually seeking to observe how things land in their body, how their interactions affect each other, a real curiosity about unpacking the complexity so that we can move through to some space of profound simplicity and recognize where there are universal truths that can emerge despite the global differences, despite the differences that are so, the multiplicity of differences. That for us is so powerful. And along with that is addressing the whiteness of the growth system of capitalist economics. And even of the post-growth and degrowth movements, there's so much emphasis in those spaces that are trying to reform the global economy or change or move to a post-capitalist system. There's still so much emphasis on white, male-bodied or male-identifying perspectives. They're coming, most of the literature, for example, or the speakers are like myself. They're white and they're male. And in other cases, they're based in Northern Europe. That for us is an important piece of the conversation and the explorations, but it's only part of it. And in fact, for us, the more important part, as we almost open with today discussing Islamic finance, is to recognize the pluriverse. As my colleagues at the Global Tapestry of Alternatives will speak to, and Srishti Babpai, for example, will speak to this pluriverse of perspectives. That's a crucial centering. Not to say that there aren't then ways that we can say, here's what we think post-growth is and what it means and have perspectives on things, but to start from the point of recognizing that the marginalization of the very distinct and perfunctory marginalization of certain perspectives has done a disservice to us all. It has left out so much of the richness of what is possible based on people's experiential sharings of their learnings of like, in my community, this is what happened. I mean, in Argentina, for example, what I'm struck with when people ask me, what's it like there? I say, well, there's a kiosk every six houses in my rural neighborhood where people sell things. Like the distinction between urban areas filled with housing and the place where you would go and purchase something from a supermarket, for example, is nowhere near as distinct here as it is in the US. Here, just about every neighborhood has hundreds of different places where people are selling things from their backyards. That kind of experience that can open perspectives for people who might have only been introduced to certain ways of being and seeing is such an important piece of this post-growth movement, this post-growth shift, and even the self-defining of what post-growth means. We don't seek to impose a notion of what a post-growth fellow must do. We just start from those pieces I mentioned earlier before about humility, curiosity, and this commitment to collective thriving within ecological limits through a post-capitalist lens. That's where we draw a line. So I think that creating the space for that, it's definitely our hope that there's going to be a soup of sorts that continues to brew as these fellows get to interact with each other. And then as we, those of us reading the content or watching the content or engaging with what the fellows are bringing to the wider space, then see shifting internally for us as their fellows' words and artistry, etc., lands in our bodies in ways that can hopefully reveal and open some new spaces for exploration.
Donny, I'm sure there are many listening that are probably leaving this conversation moved and incredibly inspired by the vision you have today. So you have the fellows that are already, you know, they may have already begun their journey, but then there are also those that are trying to learn more and trying to understand what is the best place to begin their own journey. What are some initial steps that organizations can take to shape a post-growth economy?
Such a great question. I'll start with individuals and it'll merge into organizations. I'd say I'd split this into two parts. One is a perspective shift, perhaps, and the other is practical actions resulting from that. I feel like there's immense value when we begin with looking at what's working. So I encourage people to look in their families, communities, in their regions, and even through to the nation state and say, what's working that I feel could be part of a regenerative future, could be part of a post-growth future, something that could actually be sustainable, as in if everything was like this in terms of the underlying principles, we could actually thrive together. And so whether that's looking at how things operate in your community when disasters occur, for example, maybe there's networks of mutual aid, or thinking about how your family actually spends quality time on a regular basis in a certain way, whatever it is, looking at those things and then sharing with others your appreciation for those as a way to actually counter so much of the media and conversational narrative, which can easily fall into what's wrong, what's not working, which takes us into the back uncreative parts of our brain. So that's the first thing I'd say is try to use the learnings from asset-based community development, appreciative inquiry to focus on what's working to see where that takes you. And sometimes it'll take you into what's not working, which is great. You use that as a vehicle to safely move into that conversation. But to really begin with what's working can open up possibilities creatively that you might not have experienced were there before. And then in terms of practically from that space of what's working, moving your money, if you've got any money in bank accounts, moving investments, if you've got any investments, moving your time, if you have any available time, moving your time related to labor, I should say, if you have that ability, moving your advocacy, all in the direction towards the things that you're identifying already work. So I've outlined some things that I think from a principal perspective work better, which is not-for-profit forms of business. That means if you've got any money in a bank account that is for profit, and you might have to go and find out, you know, who owns your bank. If you discover it's a cooperative bank that isn't owned by any individuals, fantastic. If not, can you shift your money over to that kind of bank? Can you move your labor over into a not-for-profit organization, whether that's voluntarily if you have that privilege, or in a paid capacity and actually help galvanize those forms of business? Can you move over your advocacy to actually supporting laws and the organizational entities that are doing the circulation of money, power, and resources through their legal structures? Can you find ways to support these shifts or even indeed our work in this area by supporting our organization? These, I think, are ways that you can walk through the world realizing that every single interaction you have, especially monetarily based interaction, is actually a vote for a certain kind of system. Now, we don't all have the privilege to know where our dollars are going, or in my case, pesos. But the more we learn about who is actually accumulating underneath the structures around us, the more we can actually then seek to steer our conscious or to align our values with the ways that we're actually using our exchange in this world to create that more beautiful world our hearts know is possible.
And what are some helpful resources that they can lean on? And where can those listening connect with the Post Growth Institute and your own resources?
For those interested in our work, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Mastodon, and LinkedIn. Just by searching Post Growth Institute and also at postgrowth.org. You'll also find a lot of relevant groups at postgrowthalliance.org, which introduces you to other groups around the world. And I want to do a shout out here for the Global Tapestry of Alternatives. a wonderful collaboration of entities and individuals based out of India and Latin America that that I think is a really great entry point for a lot of people interested in these sorts of movements for change. And then I would encourage people to search for terms in English anyway, like mutual aid, if that's a new term for you, and to really think about what you can do often in your own individual life. A lot of the focus of sort of steering people towards individual actions has been quite rightfully so critiqued as part of a neoliberal agenda to move things away from the systems change that's needed. But if you're doing things on a local community level yourself, if you're searching for things on the web that can inspire you to make some changes in your community that are addressing systems change, which I would say fundamentally means you're addressing questions of ownership and power, then that can be sometimes some of the most powerful things. So just going on your own journey in that area and learning more about how money accumulates and ways that money can circulate, because that's at the root of then power and then ultimately natural resources and the environmental and climate change related aspects of this come into play at that point as well.
Donny, thank you so much for enlightening conversation and for sharing just so many incredible ways we can collectively work towards building a better future. I'm so grateful for the work that you do and that the Institute is stewarding, and we're really excited to be a part of it and are looking forward to what the future holds for a post-growth economy.
Thank you so much, Shiza. And to all of your listeners, courage. These are challenging times that we live in, and we need courage more than ever. And I'm encouraging everyone to continue to explore with curiosity the possibilities that might emerge when we move into the unknown, with a sense of courage that amazing things can and will come through these challenging times.
That is a beautiful note to end on. Thank you, Donny. With this incredible episode jam-packed with tremendous solutions to building a better world, this brings season 2 of Re-envision Business to a close. A huge thank you to Donny McLurkin, Irene Sahan, Catherine Trebek, Jessica Mason, and Arpita Bisht for contributing to this conversation. Thank you so much for supporting and listening along to our conversations this season as we dug deeper to discover innovative approaches to responsible trade. A special thank you to Rohan Singhal for editing this episode. To ensure you are notified of future conversations on impactful strategies and organizational practices, please subscribe or follow Re-envision Business on your favorite podcasting platform, whether that is Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or something else. If you enjoyed our episode, please leave us a review and share the episode with your community so that others can learn about the incredible work that so many people are stewarding to build a better future for us all. You can connect with us and learn more about our work at www.theupeffect.com. Thanks again for listening.